Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. My answers are posted every week on Mondays, and you can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask me, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Suppose two men apply for a job. Both are qualified, but one is clearly more qualified than the other. The less qualified man knows he is less qualified, but he gets the job anyways. Is this unjust? What should he do? He should take the job. The less qualified man should accept the employment. He is not the employer. It is not his function to decide who gets the job or who works at that company. Perhaps the boss or the employer saw other intangibles in him or in the other that swayed his judgment in favor of what he is seeking. But that is none of your concern. If there is no fraud involved, and if you are not distorting your curriculum vitae, your resume, so the boss knows the truth, then it's absolutely wrong for you to sacrifice because somebody has a better ability in your opinion. Egoism prohibits that. It's not injustice if somebody with a lot of talent doesn't get a job because you're not entitled to that. It's only if the man saw that you are the best, that he is the best, and then didn't give him the job, the man would be being unjust. But you're not being unjust, and presumably the boss isn't, and the other guy has no claim. If he's that good, he'll find a good job somewhere else. I mean, unless employment becomes 100%, which, you know, is coming close. Now, if you take the job and your ability is not up to it, obviously you're going to find out pretty soon and you will exit. And, you know, then you can say, I recommend Mr. Smith if he's not already employed. By the way, I actually had an exact statement like that in regard to philosophy. When I was young, I was offered a position and there was someone else who I thought was definitely superior to me. And I even spoke to the employer and said, I think so-and-so is superior to me. And he didn't listen. He said, I'll judge. But Ayn Rand found out about it. She flipped out that I would do that. And she gave basically the speech that I just gave, but longer and more impassioned. Don't you think most people seek religion and mysticism because they wish to escape death? No, I don't believe that. They don't want to escape death. They want to escape the requirements of life, specifically self-sufficiency. Life is self-sustaining action, self-generated and self-sustaining. And that is what they don't want to have to rely on. They want an omnipotent crutch who will free them of the consequences if they have faith. They want to be able to act on their feelings with the idea that there is no absolute, no rational absolute to stand in their way. Nothing to stop them from getting away with it. Now, I don't believe that these people love life so much that they are yearning to have ever more of it for eternity. I don't believe that. I don't mean to imply by this that everybody who believes in God has this psychology, but I think there is an element necessarily of it. Now, other reasons, I'm sure there are many other reasons, and maybe as a peripheral reason, some people are afraid of death, but I don't think that's a primary reason. With all due respect, who do you recommend we direct our questions to when you are no longer available to answer them? I don't know whether that means when I die or close down the podcast, but the only answer is, I think, what you're really directing your questions to now, if you're using the right method, to yourself. You have to figure out yourself what the answers are, and you can get assistance by looking up or listening to whoever you think has the great or greatest knowledge of objectivism and is available. But you have to listen to any one of them. If they do two things, they give reasons that on their face make sense and that are compatible with objectivism. And that's not so bad for you to hear. There's a tremendous amount now written, a tremendous amount of archives and radio shows and podcasts, not just mine, and lectures and books. When I came on the scene originally, there were a few people and the Fountainhead. That was it. Even We Living wasn't in print at that point. And now there's, you know, there's a lifetime of material. So you should have a lot of direction and help and insights and so on. Now, there are people on specific subjects that I have very great respect for. So if that's what you mean, now you can't take them as infallible, although I often do. But the two that were most essential to my DIM book was Dave Harriman on physics. I think he is by far the most knowledgeable physicist and philosopher of physics. And Steve Jolivet on history. Now, there's definitely others. I'm not trying to make a list here of all the reliable or excellent thinkers, but those two I myself have relied on as expert specialists in those areas that I could not get the information from anywhere else. But I think most of the questions here, given the resources, you should be able to do it without any difficulty, whether I'm here or not. Now, according to Facets of Ayn Rand, she, quote, Ayn Rand, quote, cried tears of splendor, unquote, upon seeing the New York skyline for the first time. Were these different from wedding tears? In other words, were they malevolent universe? They say no, they weren't malevolent universe, because the wedding tears were, the world is awful. It's a metaphysical view. Things are terrible, and that's the way it has to be. And this beautiful ceremony, that's the way it should be, but can't be. But hers was not metaphysical. Hers was political. It was, I got out of the country that's rotten and was choking me in order now to get into the great country. It didn't change her view of life, but the relief was, now I can live in what I always knew was the nature of reality. It's in that sense that she cries over being able to act in the world the way she always knew it was. And she did not cry easily. The only other times that I knew that she cried were in the early years when she was writing We the Living, had no money, had a full-time job and could only write at night. She quite frequently, I understand, in the evening, would cry a bit just because it was such an awful situation. She wasn't established. She didn't have time to write. She had to write. She had this job. But I never saw her cry in 31 years. Now, here's a question. I'm not sure I know, but I have an idea. How much would you pay for an absolutely guaranteed 25 additional happy, healthy, successful years of your life? Well, first of all, that's obviously impossible on the face of it. Nobody could guarantee for money happiness or health or even success, because you don't even know what I'm going to try to do. So on the face of it, it is a fantasy. But let's just take it as a fantasy. If you asked this question when I was much younger, when I was 25, even 30, and say to me, would you like to add 25 years somehow magically we'll mix your DNA with Elvis Presley records or whatever, come up with 25 extra years of life, then I think I would pay any amount to do that. Because then I'm still at the point of setting my life course, what I expect, where I'm going to be, and that's very much influenced by how much time ahead of me do I have. If I know I have a terminal disease and I'm going to die in 5 years, then I normally would not undertake a history of the world. If you set your goals as I did, you know, approximately, you can't time it exactly, but in a range of 70 to 80, then all your values are calculated from the outset that way. They build to what you see as the climax within the productive time you have. And with, for instance, my book, I've reached that. So I wouldn't know where to go from here if you gave me another 25 years. Now, I have other values, but my whole life, like the piano or writing fiction, but my whole life has been organized on the idea that these are side issues. They're like hobbies. And I simply cannot, maybe some people could, but I cannot turn it into a 25-year project. I'm just set a certain way. So if I lived another 25 years, I'd have to write another book even harder than the dim book. And that would horrify me. So I think it comes down to this. It would be, another 25 years would be like starting a new life having finished one. And when you finished one, you see, I can't see the 25 as an extension. I see it as, well, I've done one and now I'm starting over as a teenager. And that I don't want to do. I've gone through the whole process. So I don't know, maybe if you modify this that I'm a baby again or I'm a teenager again and I can't remember anything from the previous life, but you know, by the time you put all that in, it's going to be hard even to write up the contract, let alone for me to say how much I would pay for. I would certainly pay to have those body transplants where I was 21 and, you know, put in the body of a 21-year-old, that for sure.
Dr. Peikoff's new book, The Dim Hypothesis, is available in book and ebook form as of September 4th. The book deals with the role of philosophy in Western culture and politics from Greece to the present, an approach which enables Peikoff at the end to predict the future of the U.S.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peikoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.